I'm really excited and slightly anxious to announce that my book, The Autistic Burnout Workbook, is releasing this next week. It comes out March 11th. It's available for pre-order right now. I am trying to avoid falling back into burnout. When you release a book, there is a lot of pressure to do promotion and to market and to get the word out there. So this is my burnout prevention form of marketing. I'm running a special right now for those who are supporting my work through pre-ordering. You can submit that information after you pre-order, and we will get you a coupon code that you can use toward our store for the same amount. So the workbook costs $18.99. So then you'd get $18.99 to use in our digital shop or in our Etsy shop, which would get you another digital workbook for free. So you buy one workbook and then you get a digital one for free. That is the promotion I'm running. It's technically a pre-order promotion, but I've been a bit behind on getting the word out. So for listeners of the podcast, I'm going to extend that. If you buy the book in the next month, you can go ahead and redeem the special. The link for that is in the notes below. Thank you so much for supporting my work. It means so much to me, and I just really appreciate you and hope that you will find this a helpful resource for you as you continue to build a life that is a bit more resilient to autistic burnout.
Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening.
Hey there. So it is April, which means it is Autism Awareness / Autism Acceptance Month. And we're going to be doing a series around here on unpacking what is autism. We want to issue a pretty big disclaimer here. We're using the DSM-5 criteria as a framework for this conversation. And this is not our endorsement of the DSM. There have been a lot of very thoughtful critiques of the DSM in the last several years. And more specifically, how autism is presented in the DSM is very deficit-based. So we are not in alignment with that view, but we did use that as a framework to walk through our experience of autism and to unpack the many ways that those criteria could show up in a person. The reason we chose to do this is that we do believe in the power of transparency and demystifying the process of diagnosis. The process of an autism diagnosis has historically been very obscure and hard to understand. And so this is our effort for those who perhaps are interested in pursuing a diagnosis or who have gone through the process and want to understand it better. This is our attempt to help demystify that experience. It is not our endorsement of the DSM. Thank you for understanding that.
Okay. Well, welcome back.
Yes, good to see you. We haven't recorded in a while.
I know. Rhythm.
Yeah. So I love this idea. You texted me about let's do an episode on what is autism and what is ADHD. And my brain started getting excited thinking about this episode and did what my brain does, which is turn everything hella complicated and make everything a collection. I had this thought, Patrick. I'm curious what you think. I know we don't have series, which, wink, I'm open to. but I think we should have mini collections. So I honestly think we could do 10 or more episodes on what is autism, because it's a philosophical question. It's a scientific question. We can get into the diagnostic criteria. We could bring in people and ask what autism is to them. But I think we should make how on YouTube there's video collections. I think we should start making collections for our podcasts.
I think it's a great idea. I'm not against it at all. I actually think it's fantastic. What's funny is when I text you, oh, we should do autism 101. We should do ADHD 101. It feels very much like us to do this at episode 45, 46, whatever this is going to be, and not episode 1 and 2.
I know I had that with my website. People often be like, there's so much great resource here, but I'm like, just like at the very basic, like, what is autism? And I'm like, oh my gosh, I like don't have an article. I'm like, this is what autism is. I'm like, this is what interoception is. This is what alexithymia is. But like, what is autism? Yeah. So that is very appropriate. I think it'll help organize the chaos if we have a little mini series. And I know, like, I know your inbox is full. My inbox is full of like people asking to come on at this point. And like, we can organize who comes on also through our little mini series. Definitely more Ask a Neurotype, but. Plus I love building collections. I don't know if you know this about me.
I do. I actually agree with like the subset / like mini series collection, whatever we want to call it. I would love to expand on the neurotype series too, just to get so many different perspectives on there. Those are really popular ones.
Yeah.
So if we are starting like foundationally, and someone just finds this podcast or wants to send it out as a resource, what is autism is probably a good starting point, not just for the listeners, but for people's loved ones, for therapy clients, for therapists. Like, yeah.
And it's, well, okay, I have so many thoughts. But first, I just want to ask you, like, how would you answer that? If someone came up to you and like, Patrick, what is autism? What would you say?
I'm looking at this.
It's a hard question, right?
Roy Kent poster I have on my wall that just says, like, fuck. But yes, it's a hard question, and I don't know where I would start. Because my brain would say, do I start with the definition of like neurodivergence versus neurotypical? Do I start with like the clinical foundation for autism, the misconceptions, the misdiagnoses, the presentations that go missed so often? Do I talk about adult autism? Like, do I share my
own about your experience of like, what does it mean to you to be an autistic adult? Yeah. Like, it's, maybe that's why we haven't done an episode. Maybe it's why I haven't written a blog post on it. It's huge. It's a multifaceted question. Like, what angle are we asking this? Are you asking what's the criteria?
Right.
What's the identity? What's the experience? What's the social construct? Yeah, we can't do this in one episode.
So this is just going to be dipping our toe into this conversation, and we're probably obviously going to expand upon it. I also find it fascinating, and I text you this, that I was like, we should do ADHD 101, we should do autism 101. And we both were like, yeah, we're going to start with autism 101. And I think that feels like this podcast in a nutshell. Like, both of us are autistic ADHDers, but I think so much of our worldview and just the things we talk about are typically framed from that autistic perspective a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, it forms more of my identity. And I find that to be somewhat common among autistic ADHDers, that the autism ends up forming a little bit more of the core identity, I think, unless you're ADHD dominant. But I do want to do an ADHD series. I honestly don't feel like I understand ADHD as well. So part of it is my own, like, I'm like, give me time to go do some research, Patrick. Then let's do ADHD 101.
We'll see y'all in 25 with ADHD.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so
what is autism? Or I just cut you off. Go ahead.
I think I was going to say the exact same thing. So yeah, I think we start there. What is autism? And we can go through, like, you know, very broadly, like, diagnostic criteria, and then stage, and then expand upon like experiences, philosophies, all the things. Hell, we need to do an episode on a neurodivergent affirmative language too. Just popped into my head, but we haven't done that either. So
yeah, we don't do a lot of like how to's, I think, because we are so conversational. But that would be a good resource. So So situate, like, the what is autism? This is a like very current, fresh debate. You know, historically, it's been a neurodevelopmental disorder, that's how it's been categorized, very much characterized by the behavioral markers. But we're seeing this huge shift as we're shifting from the medical model toward the neurodiversity paradigm, a shift from this being a medical diagnosis to this being an identity, right? This being a neurotype. But even with that, it is wrecked with ambivalence in the sense that, like, we cannot locate, we can't be like, this is the autism gene. There's hundreds and hundreds of genes involved, and there's so much diversity that it's like, there's so much debate around this. Is it captured by behavioral traits? Is it captured by, like, distinct brain patterns? Especially as we move more toward identity-based, this idea of how do we define what this thing is?
Which really makes it a challenging conversation to have in, like, a short period of time. So I think that's a good starting point with that disclaimer, right? If we're shifting into that neurodiversity paradigm perspective, identity first perspective, especially as we start to see, you know, more and more autistic advocacy, trying to shift into different types of affirmative language to kind of shift away from the usage of ASD, certainly the usage of the label Asperger's, like all the things that still get thrown around a lot of the time. So I think also trying to figure out how to speak about that, how to educate, how to teach, because we've talked about, like, how do we do that without becoming angry, without becoming, like, really defensive.
Well, this also brings you back to our conversation with Tiff about, like, for some people, their experience of autism will be, I have ASD. It will be with autism. It will be. Right. And so that is part of the identity for some people is to keep it medical.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Also, how do we honor, like, the social disability model? Mm-hmm. How do we not get too tropey in terms of language, like superpowers versus kryptonites?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And Sandra did a great job with the superpowers aspect of, like, in our episode with them around, if you have to have a superpower to justify being different and acceptable, like, there's a problem with that. I really don't care for this superpower rhetoric.
And I'll just own this, that was language that I used initially when I first discovered my own autistic journey, mm-hmm. and just had not done enough education around some of the language in general.
So yeah.
I apologize for that in the past. But,
well, I think it's great that you, I think developmentally, a lot of us, as we're coming to understand what this means and to integrate it, we go through a lot of different language use. Yeah. And even, like, our energy toward, like, I remember, I feel like I was way more defensive about identity first language early on. And now I'm like, I have a more nuanced perspective because I'm more settled in the identity. Totally. So I think even the language we use will have a developmental arc to it, in the sense that it'll shift as we get more comfortable and settle into these identities. Absolutely. So I love that that's part of your story.
Yeah, I think we have to unpack our own internalized ableism a lot of the times when we live in an ableist society. And also, I think that when we first come into an understanding about our own diagnoses, our own diagnosis journeys, our own stories about anything that, you know, feels very personal to us, we are oftentimes more defensive when it comes to protecting mm-hmm. Our newfound identity, or however we want to look at that. And then over time, you're like, I'd rather help people shift their language mm-hmm. more gently and with more education and more support, because so often people just, you know, they don't know. And mm-hmm. the DSM says, hey, this is what we have to do for insurance billing purposes, it makes sense why we're still kind of stuck in this medical model where it's like, well, we default to saying this is a spectrum disorder.
Right, right. And that, yeah, exactly. Like, we have to use certain language to get certain accommodations in the world that currently exists. Right. Yeah, yeah. There's a few metaphors that I really like that I found in the literature. Neurotype, I feel like that's widely used. And I really like that. I feel like it captures it as a brain style, as our neurology, as a way of processing the world. Robert Chapman talks about it as a different form of life. I really like the imagery of form of life. And that is a little bit more embodied than neurotype. Neurotype is very brain, and we know the autistic nervous system is different. So I like that it brings in a little bit more embodiment. And then Leon Brenner is another thinker I like, who talks about autism as mode of being. And again, it feels a little bit more embodied than neurotype. So those are the three metaphors I'm drawn to when I think about what is autism: mode of being, form of life, neurotype.
Yeah, I think if we use those three metaphors to anchor into this, that will be useful, because I agree. I think that those all feel really useful for me. And I think that has really reframed my perspective and lens that I kind of view a lot of this from now too.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a clinical psychologist. You obviously, like, you do testing. You live this stuff all day, every day. So we can get as granular as we want to, but I don't think it's useful for us to go down like each of the big six markers and milestones that we're looking for in testing capacities a lot of the time, unless you do think that it's useful to pick it apart.
I actually thought it would be a really fun structure for the episode. I have Donna Henderson's book here. I was like, we could go through criteria anyway, but then like talk about it, not just be like, da, 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 but like actually talk about our experience. And then have another episode on criteria B. So I think I was thinking the opposite. I was let's get into the trees.
Sometimes I'm like, I say something, but that's not necessarily my entire meaning. So more so, yes, let's not just list criteria. How about that?
No, that sounds so boring.
Talk about criteria and expand upon it with our own thoughts.
Yes, and our own experience. Yeah. I think that would be really fun. And I'd love to get like listeners' feedback then too.
Yeah.
So I will make another plug for this book because I think it's such a great book. Is This Autism? It's by Donna Henderson, Sarah Wayland, and Jamel White. And they have two books out in the screen book. They walk through the diagnostic criteria, but with non-stereotypical presentation in mind. And they have a section where they talk about what we've learned from the girls, knowing that it is, of course, more than just females that present that way, but like what we've learned about autism from the girls. Right. And so I think that could actually be a really helpful frame to walk through some of the criteria. And I'd love to ask you about your experiences, Patrick.
Let's do it. I actually think this will help us not diverge as much as we probably would.
Yeah, I think for talking about diagnostic stuff, it's helpful to have some anchor points. Okay, so bird eye view for we're talking DSM-5, well, DSM-5 TR. In other countries, most widely used would probably be ICD-11. It's similar. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty similar. Yeah. So there's essentially two big, I put everything in buckets, two big buckets of criteria to be aware of, A and B. A is social communication stuff. B is repetitive restrictive behavior, RRBs. So I think today let's just talk about criteria A, the social stuff.
Sure.
Okay. So there's three pieces of it. And to meet criteria, a person has to have all three or like be experiencing all three. So the first one, social emotional reciprocity. I used to think I was good at reciprocity, but I'm realizing I'm not as good at it as I thought I was. What comes to your mind when you hear the word reciprocity?
Reciprocity. Okay. So what comes to my mind is I think that when I'm masking more, I probably exude more reciprocity in social relationships and situations. I think that when I'm feeling unmasked, I don't feel that way. What I mean by that, concrete example, someone reached out to me today and said, I'm so grateful for you to be in my life. And I just liked the thing. Like, I didn't respond back with, I'm so grateful that you're in my life too. Or like, I feel the exact same way, because I just didn't feel like that was necessary. But I do think if I was asking more, I would have created some expected response of like, this is what I'm supposed to say back.
I think that, so compliments, like that is part of reciprocity. I remember, yeah, back when I was out in the world actively, like I would be scanning what the person, especially among females, we like to compliment what other people are wearing. It's this weird cultural thing. So I'd be scanning like the other person so that if they complimented me, I could quickly come back with a compliment. Cause I learned at some point, if someone compliments your outfit, you're supposed to compliment theirs, but there'd be like this awkward stall. So like coming up with compliments proactively. So compliments, that's absolutely a reciprocity thing. For me, I get annoyed by compliments. Okay. No, I like compliments, especially when they're received, I think, in certain digital formats and there's not expectation for response. Like part of me likes it, of course. Like I do have an ego. It exists. I like compliments. But part of me just gets it irritated because it's like a demand I now have to respond to.
You talked about this in our Ask a Neurotype series with Jennifer. She was talking about compliments and you were like, it feels like a demand. Like I have to respond to it.
Is that, so when you got that text, was it?
Which was from
Did
Jennifer.
It feel like a, oh, so funny. Did you feel positive toward it? Did you feel neutral?
I think I felt neutral. I know she's going to listen to this, but it's nothing personal. I just want to say that. I want to use that disclaimer. Someone I care about very much, but I think, you know, oh my God. So I think that for me, when I get a lot of that, it almost feels like, I don't think it feels inauthentic, disingenuous, whatever the word is. I just feel like it's being said just to say it. And maybe that person does need to express it, but do I need to receive it? That's the dynamic. That's the dynamic. That's the fucked up thing.
Like you're allowed to think nice things about me. Just don't share it with me. Oh, I'm laughing because I totally get that.
Right. Because I appreciate it. And I can rationally say that. I appreciate it. I genuinely appreciate it. Dot, dot, dot. But like there, it does feel like I just see so many messages throughout the day where I just look at it. And I'm like, okay, like, what, I don't know how am I supposed to respond. Like, I already know you care about me is kind of my thought process. So I don't need to hear it like over and over and over again. So like, let's talk about another form of reciprocity, which was used in my testing that I've talked about on here before. I went in for testing. The person who did my testing told me that one of the indications for him was that he had a guitar on his wall in the office, but I did not ask him about his interests after he asked me about mine. And he said that it would have made sense for me to have responded with like, I see you have a guitar on the wall. How do you play music? So that feels like reciprocity in a way, but like contextually in that environment, I'm like, I'm not here to know about you or ask about you, which that can be a whole nother conversation, but similar things. So like, in conversation, in social scenarios, like, are we reciprocating? If someone asks us about our interests, do we then turn it around and ask them about theirs?
Yeah, absolutely. So that like showing interest in someone else, that's part of reciprocity, especially if they've done the first shown interest in you. I had this aha moment maybe 6 months ago. I was talking with someone and I think they had some kind of shame around the fact that they weren't better at this. And I was like, well, what would you want? Like, would you want someone to like initiate like, hi, how are you in small talk? Or would you want someone to be asking you these questions? And they were like, no. And I was like, well, so you're caring for that person in the way you want to be cared for. Like, I think a lot of us don't necessarily want, I mean, I think if it's genuine interest, I think I know I like when people are genuinely interested in me. But if it's sure. just kind of that small talk, like, what'd you do this weekend? Oh, you've got a guitar in the wall. Tell me about that. Like, I don't like when people talk to me like that, because it's just, again, you're now forcing me to come up with something to say. Right. It's a demand. So I don't do that to other people. So it's interesting. I think from autistic culture, it's, I don't think it's a lack of caring about the other person. I think it's I'm caring for you the way that I feel cared for, which is I'm giving you space.
Absolutely. Yep. And that's why I think those neurotype series we did were so important, to kind of highlight like the different needs and different neurotypes and the different ways of moving through life, because some people really do need that, like that constant check-in validation / like affirmation. And for me, that couldn't be further from what I want. So, you know, that was a part of even dating my wife, who we've been together for 10 years. Like at first, like receiving gifts can be quite challenging. Receiving compliments can be quite challenging. So knowing what to do with that information, knowing what to do in those contexts is sometimes a indication of like that reciprocal, like this is what I'm supposed to reciprocate or how I'm supposed to reciprocate. So
complicated. Yeah, that's what. Yeah. I mean, that's what really struck me in rereading through some of the examples and diagnostic stuff is it really is allistic reciprocity. Like, I think we do have ways of showing reciprocity in autistic culture. I think story swapping, I think be like, oh, that happened to me once, right? Which is in allistic culture, that's seen as the opposite of reciprocity, because it's like, oh, you're making the conversation about you again.
Right.
But I feel like I experience a lot of reciprocity in autistic communication, but it definitely looks different.
Absolutely. So I'll circle back to this example of this DM today. I may not reciprocate in the same way. I'm saying, I feel the same way about you, like heart emoji. But what I might do is like send some gifts or some screenshots of things that make me think of that person, or I may like think specifically of their interests the same way I would think about my own special interests. And then I love gift giving in that way. Like when I see something where I'm like, oh, my friend would really like that thing because they really like this thing. I love that. That's kind of my way of reciprocating, like the, hey, I care about you. Hey, here's the statement of action.
What that reminds me of, so there's this thing, Marilyn Montero talks about this, who's the creator of the MGDOS. I love this conceptualization. I think it comes from her, of social-based conversation versus object-based conversation, that autistic people tend to feel much more comfortable with object-based conversation. So talking about, right, like maybe you're sharing a gift, you're talking about that, talking about a book, talking about an idea, talking about a special interest, versus the social base, like tell me about yourself, what did you do this weekend? So when you talk about what reciprocity looks like for you, there's a lot of objects involved as mediums. Yeah. Of I'm going to share this article that's interesting, or I'm going to share this meme, or I'm going to share this thing that made me think of you. Which is that more indirect object-based way of saying, I'm thinking about you and I care about you and I'm curious about you.
Yep. Spot on. It also is one of those things where it's like, oh, you said you were really into this this hobby 6 months ago when we talked. I just came across it while I was out in my travels and I took a picture of it for you. And they're like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, that was not something I even remembered talking about. So that's another thing that.
Oh, that's interesting. Memory, like the ability to hold people in mind. I also have pretty fantastic memory, and especially for like what people are interested in. Yeah. And I think that's a way of showing cares, is the ability to hold someone in mind, like hold conversations you've had with them in the past in mind, hold their interests in mind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to go through some of the things here. So one of reciprocity, which we've been talking about, is show curiosity about the other person. I think this probably, I would guess, is on the spectrum. I definitely don't think we show curiosity in the holistic way, unless we're masking, of like picking up. I know Donna talks about these as social breadcrumbs, kind of like at the guitar, like, oh, something interesting happened to me this weekend. Right. And then when it's like, oh, tell me what happened. Like, we don't necessarily, I think we don't intuitively do that. I feel like I have an on or off switch. I'm either like, if someone's not very interesting, this sounds so bad. If someone's just not very interesting to me, I'm not necessarily that curious about them. But people that I find intriguing, I'm like inquenchably curious about them. I want to know all the context. I want to like understand why they are the way they are. What about you? Are you curious about people?
It's exactly what you just said. First of all, inquenchably. Wow, what a word today. Yes, it's exactly like that. And I think this also plays a role in forming connections and relationships. And I think this also sounds bad. I have a rule out like immediately because, you know, I'm sure we're going to talk about like energy absorption and picking up energy, but I have a rule out pretty quickly. And if I meet you and you're interesting, like you said, I'll use your word, I can be unquenchably interested, very fascinated, very engaged. If I don't feel that way, whether it be boredom or I just don't pick up on good energy, I am probably going to respond with like very short 1 to 2 word answers and responses and almost force myself to visibly look uncomfortable in the situation as if I'm not interested in continuing the conversation.
Your like social breaks go on.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. 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 When I was masking more, I remember that feeling like the hardest like resistance would be when I'd be forcing myself to show interest and to like be reciprocal and be social when I wasn't interested. And I think that was probably a combination of ADHD and autism of like, I'm really bored and I'm having to do a lot of hard things. I'm like coaching my body what to do. I'm like telling myself what to say. Yes. Yes. And then, so autism, like the word, right, means like in your own world. So I think there's definitely some people, again, this is on a spectrum. Social motivation is on a spectrum. I think curiosity towards others. When autistic people have really rich inner lives, they might be on that part of the spectrum where it's like, I really am not that curious about other people's inner worlds.
Yeah.
And I think we've gotten a lot of requests from partnerships where like, I think that's where partnerships can struggle when it's one person in the partnership lacks curiosity about the other person's inner world. For sure. And we do see that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Also, there's non-autistic people who lack curiosity about other people, but, okay, difficulty greeting or responding to greetings. I laughed out loud when I saw that one. I mean, I think this podcast is a testament to that for me. I don't need to say more.
Yeah, I don't think we have to expand on that. But, you know, if you're sitting here listening and you're like, oh, yeah, that is something that feels complicated or I feel awkward or, you know, I struggle in these situations, it's probably something to pay attention to.
It's so like knowing what to say, like, do you shake hands? Well, now with COVID, you just don't shake hands. But like the mechanics of a greeting and then like, when is it, does it segue into a real conversation or does it not? And like, how do you know what's expected? And then goodbyes, like, yeah, I've talked about that plenty on here. I would just like escape. I'd rather just run away than actually have a goodbye.
Totally.
Because you're supposed to give lots of compliments and a goodbye. And yeah. Okay.
Find yourself sitting there nodding, saying the same thing over and over and over again, and then like backing up slowly out of the room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. or just not being in the room to begin with. Low level of interpersonal interest. And part of what goes in this is like maybe turning off when the conversation doesn't interest us. I definitely do struggle with that. But I think over time, I've created creative ways to try to make the conversation interesting. I'm going to be stuck there for a while. It's interesting. I've always thought that's more my ADHD. But if a conversation is not interesting to me, I like feel physically sick in my body. And I'm just like, I need to get out of here.
Yep. I can co-sign that statement. And I think that we've talked about this sometimes, that can be a struggle if something unexpected happens. Like you're meeting a friend for coffee, but then they bring another friend. And then you're stuck mm-hmm. in that conversation. Mm-hmm. And that person changes the dynamic, or you're no longer interested in the dynamic. And then you have to sit there for an hour. And mm-hmm. what that feels like, to have to force yourself to sit there, try to interject when you can, throw a comment in here and there, but very, very visibly like not paying attention to the actual conversation. That's what happens to me a lot of the time.
And I will say, like, I see this dynamic play out. I'll observe it in others. And I do think this is a tricky one, like in the sense that like, I see how this is hard for people in our lives. It's really interesting to have this lens and to see it where I can, if the conversation's of interest, the autistic person that in the room is so engaged and animated and alive and present and like fills up the room with energy. And then as soon as the conversation shifts to something of non-interest, like it, and not all autistic people, but I see this sometimes, it's like their energy becomes a vacuum because they're so deflated. And then I see the room deflating with it. I'm like, oh, this is really interesting.
Spot on. If I'm interested in the conversation or the situation, I can be the most charismatic person in the room. And people are like drawn to that energy. But the alternative can be true, where it's like, oof, this is very noticeably uncomfortable for not only him, but for people who are now mm-hmm. in that space or circle too.
Back to narcissism, this could look narcissistic, right? Like when they're talking about themselves or something they're interested in, they're lively, they're like the life of the party. But when the conversation shifts to someone else's interest, they get cold or mean or like whatever, however we are read. I could see how that could be one of the things that causes us to perhaps present as someone with NPD. I wish I was better at that. I do. That is something I'm like, okay, I wish my brain, because it is, I do care about the people in my life and I want to be engaged in the things that interest them, but that don't necessarily interest me. Like for Luke, he loves European soccer. And I sometimes can get a little bit interested, but not really. And I would love it it would probably be good for our marriage if like I could muster more energy for those conversations.
For sure.
Or genuine interest.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's one of those things, like we've talked so much, so often about like some of the grief that we have in general, sometimes about our own experiences and how other people that are close to us experience some of our, you know, the things that we struggle with. I think it's one of those things where I wish I could outthink it. Like I wish mm-hmm. I could really tell my brain or my body to be like, you should be engaged. You should be excited about this. And mm-hmm. I haven't been able to figure out that solution yet. So
I hope this is okay to say. I think it's happened to me too, but there's been times in our podcasts, especially when there's three of us, where like you disappear and I want to be like, Patrick, come back.
Yeah, that's fair. That's
and I can tell. I'm like, Patrick is bored right now.
Patrick's he's gone.
He's gone.
Yeah, it's totally fair to say. Yep.
Ooh, here's another one. Okay. Initiating an interaction. It's difficulty initiating that. Yeah. But I don't like initiating it. I mean, I guess it is difficult, but I also just, why would you? Unless, that sounds so bad. Oh my gosh. This series is going to, my true colors. I mean, this goes into social motivation, which is in another category. I have very low social motivation. I don't initiate often, but partly because I don't want to.
Yeah, I would say my social motivation is a bit higher than yours.
I would say so.
I probably do initiate interaction more often. I think I crave it quite often, actually. I think my balancing act is like actually the definition of balance of like, don't overdo it. Don't push yourself past your limitations and struggles because otherwise you pay for it via autistic burnout. So yeah, I think in relationships that I want to have, I have no problem initiating. But in the relationships that feel more like acquaintances or going back to what I said about putting people in buckets very quickly, if you fall into one bucket and there's not a lot of motivation there, then yeah, initiating that interaction, there's very low likelihood that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've shared this on the podcast before too, I know, or like if I'm walking and I'm going to cross someone, like I'll cross the road so I don't have to have any kind of initiation. I will actively avoid. It's interesting that when you say that, you do have more social motivation than me. When I think about our text conversations that happen outside of the podcast, I think you're usually initiating.
Yeah, for sure.
Sorry.
There's no apologies necessary. Like, I think I have good insight into our dynamic and friendship. So I'm just like, I'm thinking about Megan. I'm going to text Megan. And if Megan doesn't text me back for 6 days, that's okay. I'm not going to take it personally because I know the inner workings, though. I think that can be more challenging when you don't, right? Like, so if you don't have context clues, if you don't know about someone's needs or the things that they are, you know, really focusing on in general in terms of their lives, it can feel personal, right? Like there can be probably some fallout in friendships and intimate relationships. If we're not able to better understand what we need from each other.
For sure. For sure. And that's going to be the third criteria of A is friendship maintenance. And for me, I know that has been the hardest. Like I can develop quick, intense, deep friendships pretty quickly, but maintaining them is really hard. And things like that, like the fact that I don't initiate and think to reach out and text, or even how slow I am in responding to texts. That is part of why maintenance of friendships is hard for me. Unless you live with me and I like physically see you, I have a hard time. And these are people I care about deeply, like that I just have a hard time initiating. I think I am more autistic in the way, not like more or less autistic, but like autism, the word in your own world. I think I am more that way than you are. Like I get very absorbed in my world, in my mind. Like that's probably my highest autistic trait.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. I think that I kind of bounce in and out of that, but I don't spend as much time there. I don't think. I spend more time in how physically uncomfortable I am and how I'm trying to do everything in my power to avoid that feeling. That's kind of where I spend most of my time.
Wait, where do you spend your time trying to avoid physical discomfort?
Yeah, because it's like something that's on my mind all the time. So I'm just like, how can I distract myself or not have to be in that setting?
That's terrible. Daydreaming is way better. And like getting lost in ideas is way better. You should give it a try.
I love when I get lost in ideas. That's when I'm the most creative. Like that's if I feel like I'm really drifting into that space, then that's probably when I'm going to create something really cool, because that's when I allow myself to just like exist, which feels pretty good.
Yeah, you should do it more. I highly recommend it.
You just made the same face that you made when I was like, oh, I'm getting ready to host 25 people for 3 days. And you were just like,
yeah. You do stuff that like sounds like such sensory nightmare. I don't know why you do that to yourself, Patrick. Okay. I'm going to list out three more points for us to talk about. I'm just laughing at all of them. Unusually direct communication style. Check. Unexpected amount of context to the listener. Check. Difficulty engaging with the group. Check.
Moving on.
Yeah. Again, our podcast is like a testament to all of those. Okay, here's a few others that some of these are actually newer to me. Misunderstanding other people's intentions. So like a child, an autistic child, if another child kind of runs and like bumps into them or bumps their toys over, an autistic child might think that was intentional. So misattributing intentions where like actually was accidental. That was interesting to me. I think I've seen that in, like, I've seen it in children I'm around. I don't know that I've seen that in myself. Is that something new?
I don't think I've ever seen it myself. I think I see the opposite in myself where I'm like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where you assume they like you give people the benefit of the doubt?
Far too often. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Far too often than being way more susceptible to like being taken advantage of.
Yes. I guess that would go under misunderstanding intentions. And that, I mean, we know that from the research of like we are victimized at such high rates. Yeah. Knowing when someone's manipulating you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Overusing one way of interacting with others. So if it works, you just repeat it. Yeah. That makes sense. Definitely. Yeah. I've definitely talked with folks where it's like a joke worked once. So then they started using it because it made people laugh, but with limited awareness of context cues, not realizing like why that joke that they maybe learned on like YouTube, it's kind of inappropriate why that works in one context, but not another context.
Right.
And that can actually get people in trouble because it can all of a sudden something that's like funny is, oh, that's sexual harassment in this context. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we made it through reciprocity. Is there anything about reciprocity you want to add?
No, I think that feels like more than enough.
Okay. The second part of, again, criteria A, social communication is nonverbal communication. So that's things like tone of voice, rate of speech, facial, like reading, both perceptive and expressive. So reading other people's faces and then also expressing our faces, body posture, body gestures, all of these things. I don't know about you. I know for me, I just thought it was normal. I would like coach myself what to do with my body. So I'd be like, okay, this person's saying something, you want to look engaged, you should nod. But when I would watch videos of myself when I was training to be a therapist, and I was just nodding incessantly.
Yeah. I think I still do that in some situations when I'm like in an uncomfortable social situation where I am definitely like very much coaching myself how to stand, where should I put my arms? How do I like, you know, do I nod over and over? Do I just like smile constantly? It's like, probably. Like, oh, if I could just watch.
Do you know where to put your hands? I've never known where to put my hands.
Oh, if I'm like taking pictures next to people, I never know what to do. Do I put them in my pockets? Do I put them behind my back? Do I like put my hand on my hip? Like, I never know what to do.
Oh my gosh, I hate pictures. Do you hate pictures?
I hate pictures. I have to force myself to laugh. So we were doing headshots for our group practice 2 years ago, and I had to keep like, because like it's very hard to smile like just on command, like Yeah, no. So I would have to keep going, like, and the person next to me was like, "What the fuck are you doing?" Like, I can't, this is what I have to do. Otherwise, every picture is going to be like,
"Oh my goodness!" I was once. Oh, this is a random flashback memory. So my first year of college, I was in California, and in California, you can go to, like, you can actually get paid to, like, go to shows. Can't remember what show. It's something like America's Got Talent or another one. And I went with some of my dorm mates, and we dressed nice because there's like a competition. Best dressed is you get $100. This is how they make audiences look nice, by the way. There's like all these things that go into it. So we're in the front row, and they would tell us like applause, clap. And at some point the like producer guy was like, "You're just really like not happy, are you?" Or something, like, because I just couldn't, like, I couldn't get animated and like do the smiley thing. And he, it was, I guess it was so bad that he like made a comment because, you know, here I was in the front row ruining their show.
Makes me just think about how often a lot of us have experienced comments like that. Like,
I was at Starbucks doing some work like a year ago, and an older man came up to me and was like, "Shed," and I'm like, "You're working too hard," or like, "Put a smile," like that stuff that like that females get particularly a lot of from especially older men, of like smile. I hate that shit. Both the feminist in me of like, I can do what I want with my face, but also the autistic in me of like, why do you need that performance from my face?
Can't tell you how many times someone has made a mention of my face of like, "You look so despondent, you look so sad, you look so like unimpacted, you look so depressed, like you're a wet blanket," stuff like that. Like, where I'm just like, what? I'm just existing here. That's it.
That can mess with us. I had a friend in the program, in my doctoral program, and he was definitely an empath. So when he would ask me something, I would take it seriously because I knew like he could absorb energy. But sometimes he'd be like, "Are you okay?" And then I'd get in my head of like, "Am I okay? Am I not okay?" And I didn't know I wasn't okay. And I think sometimes maybe he was picking up stuff, but I think sometimes it was just my flat face,
right,
makes it look like I'm not okay. When I'm fine. It's just, that's my face.
Totally. Yeah. Same boat many times.
Mm-hmm.
Except there are times when I'm in situations where I cannot fix my face. And that's something my wife would tell me is like, if I'm going to express something, I'm just like, I think I make this expression a lot where I'm just like, "What the fuck?" And that can be problematic in social situations.
That is interesting. I mean, that's the flip side, right? Like, so we can, many of us can have a flat affect, but also we can have a harder time hiding our natural responses. Right. So if someone says something shocking or offensive or does something, like, our face is going to show it often.
Totally. Yep.
Yep. Reminds me of like how much we value authenticity. Like, we have to really work against the grain of our nature to be inauthentic. Like, we have to mask to do that.
It's amazing how often like my business brand is essentially always like remembered as, "Oh, you're so authentic, you're so..." I'm like, I'm not doing anything to be different than who I am, though. That's the thing, is like when I'm offering coaching for people or services for people, and they're like, "We just like that you tell it like it is. We just like that you're very straightforward. We just like how authentic you are, how real you are, how you're not fake." And I'm like, 37 years and counting, I haven't been able to change that. Like, that's just...
That's so interesting. That was always the feedback I got too, like in professional settings. People will be like, "We really like how much authenticity you bring," or vulnerability. Yeah. That's also an interesting one of like, I do bring vulnerability but I'm also like so guarded. It's really an interesting paradox.
It's that like vulnerability through authenticity, though. It's that vulnerability by showing up as your authentic self, right? Because it's like I'm allowing myself to just show up the way that I'm experiencing whatever the case may be.
Yeah. 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 There needs to be like two uses of the word vulnerable, like one in like how you show up authentically and then one like relationally.
Right.
Body positioning, body posture. I know for me, sometimes I'll think people are done with conversations before they are, because like if they're crossing their arms or if they look away, it's like my analytic brain has learned, oh, they're looking for something more interesting. They're done. So sometimes like I've had times where I've just like awkwardly left, or I'll be like, okay, bye, because they've looked away. So right. I'm hypervigilantly aware of people's body posture, which I think is a compensation for the fact I'm intuitively maybe not as easily able to pick up, is this person done with this conversation? Are they interested? Yeah.
Happens all the time. It happens on phone calls especially too. Like if you're reading the inflection in voices, or we just don't always pick up on inflection in voices. But I have removed myself from social situations prematurely so many times and then had to be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like you were still talking about the thing that you took a 180-second pause on. I'm sorry, I'm back. Okay. Like I've even said goodbye to a sentence and then like walked away.
I don't know if this was part of your core schema, but for me, it was also the assumption being that people aren't that interested in me, or I'm not that interesting of a person. So the default assumption is, unless I can like really tell they're engaged, that people are going to want to leave the conversation. And so because that was my core schema, it's like as soon as I would see any of those signs, then it's like I was trying to give them an out by leaving first.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like this like checkbox, like light bulb moment goes off where it's like, okay, we're done with this. They're no longer interested in this interaction. So now I need to remove myself from it to prevent them from having to endure it any longer.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. There's also like, I almost wish there was someone who was autistic on the podcast who's not like us, because there's another presentation, right? Like the stereotypical presentation where there is the person struggles to pick up that the other person in the conversation is done and they keep talking. And then over time they get negative feedback like from people around that. So that is also a like classic autistic presentation. I would say the more stereotypical presentation of they're not hypervigilantly cued into body posture, right. and they're missing stuff. And then they get negative feedback from the world because of that.
Yep. Which reinforces a different core schema.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Eye contact is part of this. Have we talked? How do you feel about eye contact? Do you do eye contact?
I mean, I would prefer not to.
Your face was my face when you just had the face of disgust.
I would like to make it like briefly as a check-in point to like check back in. Okay, are we still engaged? Are we still talking? Are we still, you know, whatever the case may be, but it's so uncomfortable for me, and I would much rather look down. I'd much rather look all over the room. I'd much rather like not have to make really intense, focused eye contact.
I don't know how anyone enjoys that. Like,
quick story is when I was in Sedona a couple months ago with some friends, I told you I was like, I want to be very open to all the Sedona things, tarot readings, aura readings. The person who did my aura reading literally like for 30 minutes leaned forward from like across a desk and made hardcore eye contact without like blinking for a half an hour. And I was so uncomfortable that I was just like sitting like this answering questions. And my friends who were in the room witnessing this were just laughing so hard that they're like, this is awful for us, and we are okay with eye contact. We knew how uncomfortable you were. So
that was so intrusive. I can't believe you managed that for 30 minutes.
It was not fun. But yeah, eye contact, you know, and then I think about like job interviews too, right? How often people have to like go into job interviews and if they weren't making eye contact, what the perception could be of like, this person's not really interested in the position. This person doesn't really want to be here. So whenever I interview staff or my group practice, I'm always like, listen, if you want to turn your video off, turn your video off. If you don't want to make eye contact, please don't. I want to make sure you feel comfortable. So I think eye contact, yeah. It feels intrusive. It feels uncomfortable. It feels like I want to crawl out of my skin most of the time.
Yeah, that nails it. I want to crawl out of my skin. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I didn't even realize I did this, but I mean, I think I did some eye contact, but I mostly like would look at the space in between people's eyes. And then I actually look at people's lips mostly because I have some auditory processing stuff. And so I have a hard time understanding what the person's saying fully without that. So I realized like, I just always looked at people's lips. And I guess I never thought to be like, oh, this is weird that I'm not looking at people in the eyes. But because I was looking at their face, maybe it wasn't as obvious.
Right.
Yeah, eye contact.
Ugh. Oh, just for my own purposes, I do have to jump into that other meeting in like 5 minutes.
Yeah, so we should wrap this up.
Like, I want to come back to this because I'm really enjoying going through it like this. I think this is a really great way to do this episode. So thank you for suggesting that.
Well, good. I'm glad. I thought I was like, oh, when I suggest the DSM, I think it's going to sound really deflating and boring. But I like this way of like going back and forth and digging into what these things can look like. But yeah, you have a meeting and we have, you know, like 9 more episodes of What is Autism that we should do.
Yeah, this is a good way to do it though. So wherever we leave off today, we can just pick up from the next time we record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds good. Go enjoy some great eye contact and small talk in your next meeting.
It's actually an interview. So I'm going to model exactly what I just said, which is like, hey, if you want to turn your camera off, if you don't want to make eye contact, there's no pressure here. So that's part of the goal of creating a neuro-inclusive and neurodivergent affirmative practice structure. So
I love that. Absolutely.
Anyway, goodbye, y'all. See you next week. Bye.